The surge in undocumented children into the United States has gotten national attention. Why and what does it mean? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. There's been a 92% increase in the number of unaccompanied children crossing the Mexican border. The Obama administration expects tens of thousands more, and most are coming from the Central American countries of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. In studio is Matthew Peters. He is the director of the Chesapeake Multicultural Resource Center at Easton. We also recently did an award-winning series with him on the influx of Hispanic immigrants into the area, both documented and undocumented, utilizing the center's resources. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me here today.
Well, first of all, what was your own reaction to this influx of children coming across the border? Was it a surprise to you? And the fact that it seems to be coming not from necessarily Mexico, but from these Central American countries.
Yeah, well, from our viewpoint, no, it didn't come as any surprise. This is something that we've been monitoring and following for a couple of years now, and we've seen a steady increase of the situation happening. The steady increase of people migrating from Central America up into America, and the steady increase of children. And we've seen a steady increase, the decrease of ages of the children that are attempting to cross the border. So we've seen this phenomenon growing and growing and growing, and it's just hit kind of that boiling point where now it's kind of spilled into national media.
Why is it that the ages have dropped lower? Why is it we're now seeing children? I mean, we're talking about children are very young, I mean, in single digits in terms of their years of age.
Yeah. Well, as I've been discussing this kind of issue more and more with people that have been coming and you know, expressing interest to learn more about it, there's no one single answer to any one of these cases. I think one of the things we need to keep in mind is that each one of these families is an individual family, it's an individual child. Each one has their own story, their own background, their own reasons for why they feel the need to come to the United States. And in terms of why the children are getting younger and younger, I think it's just because the infrastructure's there for children to get across. The transportation's there. The dangers of doing it are lessening. The reason that they're just being handed over, I think, to Border Patrol agents is a reason for that as well, so that they don't have to cross the desert. They're just being handed over and then to the American authorities. So I think that all those kind of factors put together on why we're seeing more and more children crossing the border is because the infrastructure is there to do it, and the need is there. The parents have some resources now. Either if they're working here in the United States, they have the monetary resources to pay people to do that type of transaction. So I think we know by working with them every day that, you know, they're thinking about their families. That's really what it comes down to is how do they, as this family's been fractured over the past decade or so, if they have the monetary resources to get their families put back together, I think they're now taking all the chances they can to figure out ways that they can get their families put back together.
I mean, is there a sense then or an assumption that if they're children are handed over to authorities that ultimately then they will be dispersed to wherever the other family members are? I mean, how does that work?
Again, it's kind of twofold. One is what we're seeing, and the reality of what we're seeing and dealing with is yes. It appears on our end that the authorities are very good at picking up people, capturing people, getting them processed, getting them sent to the closest family member, and then getting them on track for immigration court further down the line. We've seen this kind of grow and grow in terms of when these children are actually processed because, I'm assuming now, because of the high volumes. As we've been getting more and more children over the past year that we've been helping to get integrated with the school systems and their families, and then we help them get in touch with immigration lawyers, we see that first immigration date where they have to go to court, you know, further and further down the line, and all I can do is assume is because of the high volume. So that's the reality. Now, the other one is, do the families understand this process? And is that the reason why they're taking this chance? That would be a logical reason, and that would be one I would jump to, and I have jumped to, and I've investigated with the families I work with, and I can't see any evidence pointing to that the families understand the system or the process or what's going on or what's going to happen. Their immediate need is to get that child with them. Somebody offers to do that for X amount of dollars. They pay it, and then they just go with this. I mean, there's no thought that they understand what's going to happen when they get to the border, or that they understand that papers are going to be given and they're going to be able to get released to their families. They just know that there's a way to pay for the child to get there and to eventually get here. So there's no strategic planning on their part on understanding how our immigration system works. Many of us don't understand how our immigration systems work. So the talking to the families and trying to see if they understand, I haven't seen any evidence of that from our case studies.
Yeah, because one of the media narratives has been that word is being spread in these countries that, particularly this White House, but that if they send their children, they more than likely will be able to stay. Obviously, it's become a partisan issue. Mm-hmm. I think it was Virginia Republican Bob Goodlatte talked about the idea of the recent surge of children, teenagers from Central America showing up at our southern border is a made a disaster, that word has gotten out around the world about the president's lax sure. immigration policies. And there is, I've seen reporting where they say, well, the people who engage in getting people across the border, they're going out and telling families, you know, if you get them over here, that they will probably be able to stay. Have you seen any evidence of that? What's your reaction to
yeah.
that?
So again, kind of my backstory is I left Central America in 2012. So it's been almost 2 years now that I've been back. And kind of from the moment that I've been back, I think that was right around the same time that this deferred action for immigrant children was passed and started going to effect. And at the same time is when I started my role as director of this resource center. And right away, I was helping families get their children who are coming across registered into schools. And even though I understood the law, I knew that these children coming across weren't eligible. But regardless, we need to get them in school and we need to get them taken care of while they're here. And my first reaction was that. My first logical thought was all of these families are getting bad information thinking that what just passed. So I started communicating with my town and that I'm very familiar with in Guatemala and the people there on the ground. And I was like, have you heard anything about this? They're thinking about now sending their children. And across the board was, what? We don't know anything about what goes on in the United States, what goes on politically, what bills are being passed, what they mean. That information is not getting down to the villages and towns or anywhere really in towns in Guatemala. Talking then with the families, if that was part of the reasoning, again, I have seen zero indication of that is one of the reasons of this influx over the past couple, well, I've seen it at least for the past couple of years, but more drastically since January. I can't see any correlation. It makes logical sense to us,
right?
But when you follow up on it, it is really just two different. It's just a coincidence that these are happening at the same time, but one does not affect the other, at least that I can see. And talking with people on the ground in Guatemala, talking with the families that are here, again, I have seen no indication that is one of the reasons behind this influx.
Now, we talked a few years ago, last year, we were talking about some of the reasons why they come. And one, of course, is the violence. And I was looking at particularly understand that the gang violence is very bad down there. There was apparently some kind of gang truce in El Salvador and some of the urban areas of Guatemala. That apparently has evaporated, what I'm reading. And in Honduras, the homicide rate is tripled in the last decade, and it's highest in the world for a country not at war. It sounds like there's violence that's escalating down there. What are you hearing in terms, and particularly as it relates to people leaving?
So those are the correlations that I think and that I hear. When I talk back to the town down there, I mean, sometimes when we measure violence, it is just in homicide rates, and they are the highest. If you look at the highest countries in the world right now for that homicide violence, it is Honduras is number one. I think followed closely by Salvador and Guatemala are all in the top five. So combining those three countries, which are all close to each other, it's called the Northern Triangle of Central America. That is the most violent region in the world and has been for a number of years. But that violence carries over to all other things. Violence, you know, there's just theft, robbery, kidnappings, extortions, a lot of those things that aren't so easily reported or even made clear to the authorities that this is happening, that is on the rise as well. Talking to families down there, it's just, you know, every week it's case after case, and it gets, everyone is just affected by either the violence or the theft, the poverty, armed robbery. I mean, across the board, it's been getting worse. Other correlations, obviously, not just the violence, it's just the, if you look at the hunger, if you look at how many children have been dying from hunger, I think Guatemala is now, I think I last read last week, around 32 children have died this year alone just from hunger. And that's something that has never even registered on being measured before. So that's a direct correlation with just the extreme poverty that's happening, the access to food, the access to resources. We know that Central America is rich in resources. So measuring how many resources are down there doesn't equate to how accessible these resources are. So talking with families down there, it's just becoming increasingly difficult to get the basic needs, food, medicine, even shelter. So that is what is on the people's minds down there in Central America, are those correlations. And again, I think that's what translates directly to this push of this mass exodus of people from Central America.
It's noticing, by the way, that not only is there an increase in undocumented folks coming across the border here in the United States, but I believe it's the UN High Commissioner for Refugees is talking about Mexico, Costa Rica, Panama, Nicaragua, Belize. They are all seeing an increase in folks coming out of those Central American countries into their countries, just simply seeking either asylum or just a place to live. Mm-hmm. That seems to indicate that there's a real regional problem in addition to whatever we see coming here to the United States.
There's a regional issue. I mean, I limited experience with a lot of this, but one of the experiences I did have directly when I was in Guatemala was I did do a investigative report with the BBC where we followed migrants up through Guatemala and into Mexico to see their journey, to see what was going on, and met a lot of people that, you know, were directly affected by being either kidnapped or, you know, they saw people being murdered by the gangs as they were making this journey upward through. And to my amaze, and this was pretty much in my backyard where we were following these people that I've never come in contact with because they just kind of come through very quickly through our region in Guatemala. And I was amazed by the number of people from Brazil, by the number of people from Ecuador, by the number of people from Panama that we met through the interviews that we were doing. And I had no idea they were coming through our backyards. I think that can be attained to just the education. I think when people hear about America and they see America, that's all the education they have about America. So it's that dream. I mean, that's still what's being sold down there. Every time you hear about America in Central America, it's the positive America dream. I think that's what's bringing them, is that positive American image. Of course, they don't understand the realities once they get here. They don't understand the laws. They're not studying that. They're not studying American law, American history, American politics, Americans. No, they just see and hear this American dream, and they try and equate it to their own lives. So when we go to countries where we know minimum wage either doesn't exist or is, you know, barely enough, they hear about the minimum wage here and how much a relative makes, and then they try and equate that to their own lives. And I think that's what their focus is on, is getting to that dollar sign, because they know how much it costs now in their societies to provide for medicine, to provide for safety, to provide for an education. And so much of that is just not accessible because they don't have the money to get to those resources. And then when they hear about the amount of resources they could possibly get here, that's why I think lots of countries are coming here, because it's the only message getting down there is the positive America dream, which America does very well at pushing. And then when people come to partake in it, we start quickly trying to give them another message of no, not for you type of thing. So I think, on Friday, Vice President Biden was in Guatemala, you know, explaining to people that you will be deported. And last night I talked to my family's down there, and I was like, so what did you think of the vice president's words? Who? He was in Guatemala Friday. Oh, we had no idea. We don't listen, you know, we're not interested in what the Vice President of the United States has to say. And then if he's talking about you're going to be deported, well, that's always been the case. That's always been the fear. That doesn't change the situation that these families are facing and their reasoning behind trying to get to a better life.
Now, the fact that there are a lot of children coming over, particularly, say, I mentioned the fact there's single digits in terms of age. And what I've seen from some of the news reports is that some of them don't seem to even know, can even not tell immigration, for instance, who their parents are. I mean, they don't, or the relative, for instance, that they're mm-hmm. supposed to see. Particularly if you were advising the immigration authorities just to figure out how to dispose of this problem in terms of getting the kids out of these big, gigantic places where they don't want them anyway. How do you sort that out? And what do you hear from people that you talk to? I mean, is it a situation where you have a lot of kids that don't know exactly where they're supposed to be going?
Absolutely. I mean, yes. I mean, I see that a lot. And I feel for those border agencies that are trying to figure out. I know how I feel when I get a client that comes in and we're trying to just get them to that next step. Whether it's to an immigration court, whether it's just to get enrolled in school, whether it's just to get, you know, rent paid or whatever, they have no identification at all, zero. They can't remember their birth date. It's something that I saw all the time in Guatemala when I would ask people their birth date. Most people just had no idea. It wasn't something that was so important that you would memorize something like that. The basic reading and writing skills aren't there. So I get that cases like that, and it's, you know, we try and be as compassionate, but on our end, it's very frustrating because how do we get to that next step if we can't even, you know, correctly spell the name or know how to correctly spell a person's name? Or, you know, and then when we ask, and I know lots about particularly Guatemala. So when I get clients from Guatemala, I'm very excited to talk about their region and, you know, their history and their events. And I would say very few, if any, of my clients even know, have been to the capital of Guatemala or have been to any of these kind of urban areas or out of their even villages. So they don't know what's going on in the town over from them in Guatemala. They don't know what's going on with their politics in Guatemala. Even in that country, they're very disconnected. So when they come up here and we're trying to figure out exactly what, yeah, I would say that's a very common thing that's happening down there, is just trying to figure out, you know, one, who exactly are we dealing with, and then where do we need to get them to? And it's sad. And then I think a lot of times we think, oh, they're lying or they don't want to tell us. Sure, that might play into some of it. I mean, just trying to understand the fear that they're feeling at that time, how scared they are at every second, put in this situation where they didn't even know what they were getting into in the first place, especially the children. And then being asked all these questions and having to come up with answers. And then when they don't know, we might think, oh, they're lying. Again, I don't have any evidence to point to where they're being coached to lie or not tell the truth. I would say it's just a fear factor where they can't express. And then a lot of times, yeah, they just don't know. You even try and ask, like, what region of Guatemala you're from? Many children just, what do you mean region? I'm just from there. They wouldn't know the specifics of many things.
Do you think that this is a wave that will dissipate, or do you think this is going to increase?
Well, just when the feeling I had when I first started working on this, again, about really diving into it about a year and a half ago and seeing the growth. I've been trying to tell other service providers, I don't see a reason why this would stop. Because my ear on the ground in Guatemala, it's heartbreaking. I mean, every night I talk to them, it's, you know, they're trying to find the silver lining in everything, but the stories are getting worse and worse and worse. So I don't have any feeling on the ground in Guatemala that there's any reason to think that things are getting better there. And then, you know, seeing the gap kind of between the disparities that we're dealing with here, I can't see any reason why it would slow down. So I try and prepare the other service providers that this is a trend that I don't see really right an immediate end to. And I keep thinking like, well, you know, people have to run out sometime. You have to, but as that the disparity in Guatemala and Central America continues to grow and affect so many people in so many different ways, I think that's what we don't, we always try and think it's one thing. But what happens when a mother of a family is in a car accident and dies? You know, what's the process? And this is an example of a child that came up this year. And then is placed, the grandma takes the child to take care of. And that works for a couple of years. And then the grandma, you know, starts to suffer from some chronic illness and can't get around anymore. And now this child is, you know, 5-6 years old. The grandmother can't even go and collect money that someone's sending to them to take care of her. She can't even do basic functions. There's no agencies there to take care of people with chronic illness. And now you have this situation where you're trying to take care of the grandma, and the grandma's trying to take care of a 5-year-old but has no resources or ability to do so. What decision process is made by a family up here in the United States that does have some resources? Well, the logical decision is we need to get that child up here. We can't leave the child in that situation down there. So one negative effect leads to a domino effect of other things happening. So sometimes it's violence. Sometimes it's, like I said, just no transit system. Sometimes it's just corruption. Sometimes it's, you know, no employment or no access to food. So there's lots of different reasons. And then one of those reasons kind of leads to so many other reasons that would lead to a final decision of we got to get them out into a safer environment where we can, you know, we can directly attend to their needs. So that's how the families are kind of working together, because they are so fragmented now. So I've met so many families that are, you know, have a brother in Mexico, and this is from Central America. They have another brother in California. They have another brother in New York. And they're all trying to somehow work together to keep everyone safe, even though you can imagine how difficult that is with limited resources and being so fractured. So that's kind of how I see is these fractured families are still, with technology, you know, using telephones and even Skype, communicating enough to figure out strategies on how to keep everyone in the family safe. And sometimes that decision is, well, we have to get this cousin or this person up here with us, and then we can attend to their needs directly. So like I said, each case, each family has a different reason on why they make that final decision. Some of it's, I've heard violence. Others is this example I gave where the mother died in a car accident, and then there's no safety net. There's no agency that comes and says, oh, you know, we're sorry for your loss. Here's, you know, some insurance money to take care of. I mean, those concepts in a developed country aren't developed. They're not there. They don't exist.
Is there anything that the United States can do? I mean, obviously it's processing these kids, and ultimately one would hope that eventually they will be, they're either going to be, they may be sent back, or they may very well be absorbed in the United States, but this is an ongoing issue, and especially as the economy begins to get better and better relative to the United States anyway. Is there a policy prescription for dealing particularly with the kind of causes for this move from, say, these Central American countries to the United States? Or is there something policy-wise? People talk a lot about, obviously, immigration reform, although that seems to be more hung up around the people who are mm-hmm. already here and may have been here actually for many years and may not even be connected with this.
Yeah.
A policymaker, what would you be thinking?
I mean, obviously some type of immigration reform. I think that would be a two-way street, because I think, many people fear it's just going to cause a larger influx. But if you look at the flip side, if you do have some members of that community that are successful, and we know some that have been successful because they work incredibly hard, and that American dream still applies to those that work incredibly hard. If we give them a status where, okay, you're here, they, and I know from talking directly with them, would love to get back to Central America and start going back there and helping directly to their families. Right now, all they can do is send a check. So I think any type of immigration reform, when we look at that, would open a two-way street. Yes, we'd get some people that would use that to come into the country, but I think we'd use a lot of people that are already here to find strategies on how to connect directly back to their country. They would, you know, most families, that the moment they do get some type of legal status, the first thing they do is plan a huge trip and vacation back to their home country, and then they do their best every make those visits back, bringing direct aid, bringing education, bringing information, good information back. So I think if we look at it that way, I think that might help sell the case of why some type of immigration reform, it's not an invite for people to come, but it's allowing people that are here to travel back and bring all those other resources, all the other news, all the other everything back to these countries that desperately need it because they are developing countries.
Do you think that that the United States, it will be up to the task of dealing with this, or are we going to be frozen in time with immigration reform sort of being talked about and something may be done, or it sounds, but from what particularly from what you're saying, is that they may not very well be talking about the right things. People talk about sealing off the border, whether it's a quote amnesty end quote or whatever it is for the people here. That's pretty much the two issues that come up, and that's it. I mean, it's are we just
It seems like we're caught in this battle of a lose-lose situation for everybody. You know, we lose money by building a wall. They lose the opportunity to come here. So we're talking always lose-lose situations. I think once we start thinking about the win-win situations, taxes, you know, small business development, the industry of people traveling back to Central America and bringing – so if we start thinking about win-win situations, I think we'll get a lot closer to finding a solution. But, you know, even, like I said, listening to the vice president's words in Guatemala, not very encouraging the strategies they're taking of, you know, trying to pay off officials in Guatemala to take care of this problem. You know, when you hear a strategy like that, it's not really getting to any win-win solution for the people or the children in this that are, you know, in these shelters. And how do we, you know, create a positive out of this, which we easily can, I think. You know, we can talk about taxes, talk about different types of payments, and talk about, you know, doing it the right way, making sure they have birth certificates, giving people an opportunity to get involved rather than focusing on, let's spend our money to build walls to keep people from not getting involved. What does that look like 10 years down the road? Does that better the conditions of these families in Central America? You know, I think we're getting there, and I think that the more that this is being talked about in public, and the more that we know that Americans who are deeply committed to this are talking about it, and it's coming up with good, better solutions than just those who aren't paying particular attention, which just think, oh, let's just build a bigger wall, that should fix it. So I think the more it's being debated, the better ideas are getting out there.
Just quickly, do you think that we will come to a turning point where the Congress and the president will do something, but it's going to be down the road, though. Or is it just too late?
It's not too late. I mean, I've been following this influx of children, and I knew it was growing and growing and growing, and then finally it boiled over to where something has to be done. I feel the same way with all these other things. I mean, yes, we can ignore it, but the situation doesn't change just because we choose to ignore it. Right. The moment, you know, we start thinking of these win-win solutions, the problem's gone. It was never a problem to begin with. It was just a matter of perspective. So I think, you know, yes, we'll get there one way or the other. And we can't forget the power of the children. I mean, these are the children that have been born here, the children that are in our schools, the children that have adapted 100% and adopted the American culture. They're going to be our voting base in, you know, very soon. So it will be their decision soon on how this country moves forward.
We were speaking with Matthew Peters. He is the director of the Chesapeake Multicultural Resource Center in Easton. Appreciate you stopping by and talking
with us. Thank you for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.